night's revels. The bird returned. Instead of chasing it away, the youngest sister spoke kindly to it and offered it a dish of corn. Then she took a damp cloth to the bird's feathers, crooning nonsense to it all the while. When the bird was finally clean, she could see it had plumage of iridescent gold and that its beak shone like topaz. It flapped its great wings and flew away, but returned every night that week, once the older sisters were gone to their parties, and sang pretty songs while the youngest did her work. On the seventh day, the bird waited until the older sisters had left to prepare for their fun, then flew in through the kitchen window. All at once there was a great flapping of wings and a sound like trumpets. There in the kitchen, where the bird had been mere moments before, the girl now beheld a handsome prince, dressed in robes of gold. "Come away with me to my palace by the sea," said the prince, "and all will pay you homage, and you will want for nothing in this life. And, as you may know, when you have had very little and worked very hard, that is no small offer." So the girl put her hand in the prince's, and away they flew to his palace by the sea. But once they arrived, the girl found that the king and queen were not so happy with his choice of a peasant bride. So the queen set three challenges for the girl. The beast snarled, and Ayama jumped, for she hadn't realized that he'd lain down quite so close to her, his snout nearly touching her knee. His lips were pulled back in a sneer.
"What a foolish story you've brought me this time," he complained. "She will accomplish the three tasks and wed the handsome prince. What joy for them both."
"Nonsense," said Ayama straight away, for she'd thought on this story quite a long time as she'd walked through the wild lands, and how the ending she'd been told as a child had seemed far more enchanting before she'd actually met and spoken to royalty. "Of course, that's not how it ends. No. Do you remember the girl's older sisters?" The beast gave a grudging nod and settled his great head on his forepaws. "It's true, they were selfish and silly in many ways," said Ayama. "But they also loved their youngest sister dearly. As soon as they found her missing and a golden feather on the chair, they guessed what had happened, for they had seen plenty of the world. They saddled their horses and rode all day and all night to reach the palace by the sea, then pounded on the doors until the guards let them in. When the sisters entered the throne room, making a racket and demanding that their sister return home to them, the prince insisted that they were just jealous sorts who wanted to be princesses themselves, and that they were wicked girls who liked to drink and dance and be free with their favors. In fact, the sisters did like all those things, and it was precisely because they'd seen so much and done so much that they knew better than to trust handsome faces and fine titles. They pointed their fingers and raised their loud voices and demanded to know why, if the prince loved their sister so, he should let her be made to perform tasks to prove her worth. And when he did not answer, they stomped their slippered feet and demanded to know why, if the prince was worthy of their sister, he should bend so easily to his parents' will. The prince had no answer but stood there stammering, still handsome, but perhaps a bit less so now that he had nothing to say. The sisters apologized for not doing their share of the chores and promised to take the girl to parties so she wouldn't have to settle for the first boy who flew in through her window. The younger sister saw the wisdom in this bargain, and they all returned home together, where their days were full of work made easier in the sharing, and their nights were full of laughter and carousing.
"And what lesson am I to learn from this story?" asked the beast when she was done.
"That there are better things than princes." Now Ayama stood, and the beast knelt before her, his big shaggy head bowed, his horns glowing.
"Do you have no more stories for me, little messenger?"
"Only one," said Ayama, the jagged knife in her hand. "The story of a girl who was sent into the wood to slay a terrible monster."
"And did she?"
"You have committed dreadful crimes, beast.
have I? Speak truth. I killed the king's soldiers, for they wanted to kill me,
he admitted.
I tried to reason with them, but people do not always hear the words of a beast.
Ayama knew what it was, not to be heard. And she also knew the beast did not lie. He might sometimes be cruel, and he was most certainly dangerous, but he was truthful, just like the thorn would. For when Ayama had awoken after her adventures, it was the wounds from the thicket that had proven all the sweet blossoms in starlight had been real. "They have told me to return with your heart," she said. The beast gazed upon her with his blood-red eyes.
"Then perhaps you should."
Ayama thought of the king who had imprisoned a monster when he might have raised a son. A king who blamed that monster for his people's suffering while doing nothing to ease it. She thought, too, of the first question the beast had asked her when she'd knelt by the pool and he'd knocked the cup from her hand. "Do you wish to become a monster?" Ayama returned the knife to her pocket and withdrew her little copper cup. "Beast," she said, "I am thirsty." The beast let Ayama bind his forepaws with the iron brambles of the thornwood, and across the wild lands they traveled. Ayama sheltered from the sun by the shadow of her towering companion. When they entered the valley and came in good time to the town, many people ran from the streets, scattering to their houses and pulling the shutters closed. But others trailed after them, staring at Ayama in her wide hat and apron, and at the beast, bound in thorns. Up the hill to the palace went Ayama and the beast, through the great gates, followed by the crowd. When the guards saw Ayama, they leapt to attention, for she walked with her head held high. She was still the same solid, graceless kitchen girl, but she was also the girl who had thrice survived a monster and who now herded him through the city. As he snorted and glared at anyone who came near, his twisted horns gleaming with mysterious light. The king did not wait for them in the throne room, but came to the top of the palace steps, in all his glittering finery, and, with the queen and the beautiful young prince beside him, looked down at Ayama and the monster.
"Why do you bring this beast to my door?" the king demanded to know. "I told you to return with his heart."
"And so I have," said Ayama in her loud, clear voice that echoed like a horn of war over the listening crowd. "His heart is mine, and mine is his."
"You think to love a monster?" the king asked, and now there were murmurs and snickers all around her. "Even a wretch like you might hope for better."
But Ayama was used to insults and paid the king's words no mind. "I will love an honest monster, before I swear loyalty to a treacherous king." She raised the thorn knife and pointed it at the king's chest. "When your wars were failing and the valley was in disquiet, it was you who slaughtered our herds and mowed down our fields, just so that we would fear a false villain instead of seeing that a fool sat the throne."
"You speak treason," roared the king.
"I speak truth.
And can this ugly beast not speak for himself?"
The beast looked upon his father and said,
"A man like you is owed no words. I trust Ayama to tell my story."
"That creature murdered my soldiers and hunters," blustered the king. "He built a tower of their bones."
"He did," said Ayama. "For you sent them to kill him when it was you who freed your son from the labyrinth in the first place. You set him loose so that you might play the hero, and we would forget our sons and brothers who die in your wars, and the taxes that gild your rooftop in gold."
"Will you allow this girl to speak such lies?" the king shouted, and though his guards did not want to obey the king's orders, they drew their daggers and fell upon Ayama.
But no matter how many blows the soldiers struck, Ayama stood unharmed. Then she took the hat from her head, and all the people saw that she was a girl no longer. Her tongue was forked, her eyes glowed like opals, and her hair twined in serpents of flame that licked at the air around her in ribbons of orange and gold. She was a monster, and no blade could pierce her skin. With her thorn knife, she slashed the brambles that bound the beast's wrists. The townspeople shouted and stamped their feet, and some turned away in terror. But Ayama stood solid and flat-footed on the ground, and her clarion voice rang out hard as a clap of thunder. "Speak truth," she commanded the king. The king had no shame, and would have opened his mouth to let the lies swarm out like locusts, but the queen spoke instead. "Yes," she cried. "He was the one who did these things. The one who locked my son beneath the earth with none to comfort him. The one who freed him just to make himself a hero to his people and make his son a monster once more." The people looked at the queen's tear-stained face, and they knew the words she spoke were true. They raised their voices once more, braying for the king's head now, and even the handsome human prince gazed upon his father with disgust. But Ayama knew mercy, and taught them as well. She allowed no harm to come to the king. Instead, she had him placed in the labyrinth, and to this day, if you pass through that particular town, in that particular valley, on a particularly quiet night, you can still hear him shouting his rage, his howls ringing off the stones as he stumbles through the prison he paid to build, swearing vengeance on the girl who trapped him there, and seeking the turn that will finally set him free. Once the king was gone, it fell to the beast to forgive his mother for not protecting him at his birth, or in the long years after. In time, because Ayama had given him something to feel besides anger, he did forgive her, and she lived out her days tending to the quince trees in her garden. After a courtship of many stories, Ayama and the beast married beneath a blood moon. And pride of place was given to Ma Zil, who had sent Ayama again and again into the thorn wood. She had not been much to look at in her youth, and she knew well that only courage is required for an adventure. As for Kima, she married the beautiful human prince, and since neither had a taste for politics, they left the throne and all its hassles to Ayama and the beast. So it was that the valley to the west came to be ruled by a monstrous king and his monstrous queen, who were loved by their people and feared by their enemies. Now in the valley, the people care less for pretty faces. Mothers pat their pregnant bellies and whisper prayers for the future. They pray for rain in the long summer. They pray that their children will be brave and clever and strong, that they will tell the true stories instead of the easy ones. They pray for sons with red eyes and daughters with horns. The Too Clever Fox. The first trap the fox escaped was his mother's jaws. When she had recovered from the trial of birthing her litter, the mother fox looked around at her kits and sighed. It would be hard to feed so many children, and, truth be told, she was hungry after her ordeal. So she snatched up two of her smallest young and made a quick meal of them. But beneath those pups she found a tiny, squirming runt of a fox with a patchy coat and yellow eyes. "I should have eaten you first," she said. "You are doomed to a miserable life." To her surprise, the runt answered, "Do not eat me, mother. Better to be hungry now than to be sorry later. Better to swallow you than to have to look upon you. What will everyone say when they see such a face?" A lesser creature might have despaired at such cruelty, but the fox saw vanity in his mother's carefully tended coat and snowy paws. "I will tell you," he replied. When we walk in the wood, the animals will say, "Look at that ugly Kit with his handsome mother." And even when you are old and gray, they will not talk of how you've aged, but of how such a beautiful mother gave birth to such an ugly, scrawny son.
She thought on this, and discovered she was not so hungry after all. Because the fox's mother believed the runt would die before the year was out, she didn't bother to name him. But when her little son survived one winter and then the next, the animals needed something to call him. They dubbed him Koja, handsome, as a joke, and soon he gained a reputation. When he was barely grown, a group of hounds cornered him in a blind of branches outside his den. Crouching in the damp earth, listening to their terrible snarls, a lesser creature might have panicked, chased himself in circles, and simply waited for the hound's master to come take his hide. Instead, Koja cried, "I am a magic fox!" The biggest of the hounds barked his laughter.
"We may sleep by the master's fire and feed on his scraps, but we have not gone so soft as that. You think that we will let you live on foolish promises?"
"No," said Koja, in his meekest, most downtrodden voice. "You have bested me, that much is clear. But I am cursed to grant one wish before I die. You only need name it."
"Wealth," yapped one.
"Health," barked another.
"Meat from the table," said the third.
"I have only one wish to grant," said the ugly little fox, "and you must make your choice quickly, or when your master arrives, I will be obliged to bestow the wish on him instead."
The hounds took to arguing, growling and snapping at one another, and as they bared their fangs and leapt and wrestled, Koja slipped away. That night, in the safety of the wood, Koja and the other animals drank and toasted the fox's quick thinking. In the distance, they heard the hounds howling at their master's door, cold and disgraced, bellies empty of supper. Though Koja was clever, he was not always lucky. One day, as he raced back from Tupolev's farm with a hen's plump body in his mouth, he stepped into a trap. When those metal teeth slammed shut, a lesser creature might have let his fear get the best of him. He might have yelped and whined, drawing the smug farmer to him, or he might have tried gnawing off his own leg. Instead, Koja lay there, panting, until he heard the black bear, Ivan Gostov, rumbling through the woods. Now, Gostov was a bloodthirsty animal, loud and rude, unwelcome at feasts. His fur was always matted and filthy, and he was just as likely to eat his hosts as the food they served. But a killer might be reasoned with, not so a metal trap. Koja called out to him,
"Brother, will you not free me?"
When Ivan Gostov saw Koja bleeding, he boomed his laughter.
"Gladly," he roared. "I will liberate you from that trap, and tonight I'll dine on free fox stew."
The bear snapped the chain and threw Koja over his back. Dangling from the trap's steel teeth by his wounded leg, a lesser creature might have closed his eyes and prayed for nothing more than a quick death, but if Koja had words, then he had hope. He whispered to the fleas that milled about in the bear's filthy pelt,
"If you bite Ivan Gostov, I will let you come live in my coat for 1 year's time. You may dine on me all you like, and I promise not to bathe or scratch or douse myself in kerosene. You will have a fine time of it, I tell you."
The fleas whispered amongst themselves. Ivan Gostov was a foul-tasting bear, and he was constantly tromping through streams or rolling on his back to try to be rid of them.
"We will help you," they chorused at last.
At Koja's signal, they attacked poor Ivan Gostov, biting him in just the spot between his shoulders where his big claws couldn't reach. The bear scratched and flailed and bellowed his misery. He threw down the chain attached to Koja's trap and wriggled and writhed on the ground.
"Now, little brothers!" shouted Koja.
The fleas leapt onto the fox's coat, and despite the pain in his leg, Koja ran all the way back to his den, trailing the bloody chain behind him. It was an unpleasant year for the fox, but he kept his promise. Though the itching drove him mad, he did not scratch, and even bandaged his paws to better avoid temptation. Because he smelled so terrible, no one wanted to be near him. Yet still, he did not bathe. Whenever Koja got the urge to run to the river, he would look at the chain he kept coiled in the corner of his den. With Red Badger's help, he'd pried himself free of the trap, but he'd kept the chain as a reminder that he owed his freedom to the fleas and his wits. Only Lula the Nightingale came to see him. Perched in the branches of the birch tree, she twittered her laughter.
"Not so clever, are you, Koja? No one will have you to visit, and you are covered in scabs. You are even uglier than before."
Koja was untroubled.
"I can bear ugliness," he said. "I find the one thing I cannot live with is death."
When the year was up, Koja picked his way carefully through the woods near Tupolev's farm, making sure to avoid the teeth of any traps that might be lurking beneath the brush. He snuck through the henyard, and when one of the servants opened the kitchen door to take out the slops, he slipped right into Tupolev's house. He used his teeth to pull back the covers on the farmer's bed and let the fleas slip in.
"Have a fine time of it, friends," he said. "I hope you will forgive me if I do not ask you to visit again."
The fleas called their goodbyes and dove beneath the blankets, looking forward to a meal of the farmer and his wife. On his way out, Koja snatched a bottle of kvass from the pantry and a chicken from the yard, and he left them at the entrance to Ivan Gostov's cave. When the bear appeared, he sniffed at Koja's offerings.
"Show yourself, fox," he roared. "Do you seek to make a fool of me again? You freed me, Ivan Gostov. If you like, you may have me as supper. I warn you, though, I am stringy and tough. Only my tongue holds savor. I make a bitter meal, but excellent company."
The bear laughed so loudly that he shook the nightingale from her branch in the valley below. He and Koja shared the chicken and the kvass, and spent the night exchanging stories. From then on, they were friends, and it was known that to cross the fox was to risk Ivan Gostov's wrath. Then winter came, and the black bear went missing. The animals had noticed their numbers thinning for some time. Deer were scarcer, and the small creatures, too, rabbits and squirrels, grouse and voles. It was nothing to remark upon. Hard times came and went. But Ivan Gostov was no timid deer or skittering vole. When Koja realized it had been weeks since he had seen the bear or heard his bellow, he grew concerned.
"Lula," he said, "fly into town and see what you can learn."
The nightingale put her little beak in the air.
"You will ask me, Koja. And do it nicely, or I will fly someplace warm and leave you to your worrying."
Koja bowed and made his compliments to Lula's shiny feathers, the purity of her song, the pleasing way she kept her nest, and on, until finally the nightingale stopped him with a shrill chirp.
"Next time, you may stop at please. If you will only cease your talking, I will gladly go."
Lula flapped her wings and disappeared into the blue sky. But when she returned an hour later, her tiny jet eyes were bright with fear. She hopped and fluttered, and it took her long minutes to settle on a branch.
"Death has arrived," she said. "Lev Jurek has come to Polvost."
The animals fell silent. Lev Jurek was no ordinary hunter. It was said he left no tracks, and his rifle made no sound. He traveled from village to village throughout Ravka, and where he went, he bled the woods dry.
"He has just come from Balakirev,"
the nightingale's pretty voice trembled.
"He left the town stores bloated with deer meat and overflowing with furs. The sparrows say he stripped the forest bare."
"Did you see the man himself?"
asked Red Badger. Lula nodded.
"He's the tallest man I've ever seen, broad in the shoulders, handsome as a prince."
"And what of the girl?"
Jurek was said to travel with his half-sister, Sophia. The hides he did not sell, Jurek forced her to sew into a gruesome cloak that trailed behind her on the ground.
"I saw her," said the nightingale. "And I saw the cloak, too, Koja. Its collar is made of 7 white foxtails."
Koja frowned. His sister lived near Balakirev. She'd had 7 kits, all of them with white tails.
"I will investigate," he decided.
And the animals breathed a bit easier, for Koja was the cleverest of them all. Koja waited for the sun to set, then snuck into Polvost with Lula at his shoulder. They kept to the shadows, sinking down alleys and making their way to the center of town. Jurek and his sister had rented a grand house close to the taverns that lined the Barshai Prospect. Koja went up on his hind legs and pressed his nose to the window glass. The hunter sat with his friends at a table heaped with rich foods. Wine-soaked cabbage, and calf stuffed with quail eggs, greasy sausages, and pickled sage. All the lamps burned bright with oil. The hunter had grown wealthy indeed. Jurek was a big man, younger than expected, but just as handsome as Lula had said. He wore a fine linen shirt and a fur-lined vest, with a gold watch tucked into his pocket. His inky blue eyes darted frequently to his sister, who sat reading by the fire. Koja could not make out her face, but Sophia had a pretty enough profile, and her dainty slippered feet rested on the skin of a large black bear. Koja's blood chilled at the sight of his fallen friend's hide, spread so casually over the polished slats of the floor. Ivan Gostov's fur shone clean and glossy, as it never had in life, and for some reason this struck Koja as a very sad thing. A lesser creature might have let his grief get the best of him. He might have taken to the hills and high places, thinking it wise to outrun death rather than try to outsmart it. But Koja sensed a question here, one his clever mind could not resist. For all his loud ways, Ivan Gostov had been the closest thing the forest had to a king, a deadly match for any man or beast. So how had Jurek vested him, with no one the wiser? For the next 3 nights, Koja watched the hunter, but he learned nothing. Every evening Jurek ate a big dinner. He went out to one of the taverns and did not return until the early hours. He liked to drink and brag, and frequently spilled wine on his clothes. He slept late each morning, then rose and headed out to the tanning shed or into the forest. Jurek set traps, swam in the river, oiled his gun, but Koja never saw him catch or kill anything. And yet, on the 4th day, Jurek emerged from the tanning shed with something massive in his muscled arms. He walked to the wooden frames, and there he stretched the hide of the great gray wolf. No one knew the gray wolf's name, and no one had ever dared ask it. He lived on a steep rock ridge and kept to himself, and it was said he'd been cast out of his pack for some terrible crime. When he descended to the valley, it was only to hunt, and then he moved silent as smoke through the trees, yet somehow Jurek had taken his skin. That night, the hunter brought musicians to his house. The townspeople came to marvel at the wolf's hide, and Jurek bade his sister rise from her place by the fire so that he could lay the horrible patchwork cloak over her shoulders. The villagers pointed to one fur after another, and Jurek obliged them with the story of how he'd brought down Alarion, the white bear of the north, then of his capture of the two golden lynxes who made up the sleeves. He even described catching the 7 little kits who had given up their tails for the cloak's grand collar. With every word Jurek spoke, his sister's chin sank lower, until she was staring at the floor. Koja watched the hunter go outside and cut the head from the wolf's hide, and as the villagers danced and drank, Jurek's sister sat and sewed, adding a hood to her horrible cloak. When one of the musicians banged his drum, her needle slipped. She winced and drew her finger to her lips. "What's a bit more blood?" thought Koja. "The cloak might as well be soaked red with it." "Sophia is the answer," Koja told the animals the next day. "Jurek must be using some magic or trickery, and his sister will know of it."
"But why would she tell us his secrets?"
asked Red Badger.
"She fears him. They barely speak, and she takes care to keep her distance."
"And each night she bolts her bedroom door,"
trilled the nightingale.
"Against her own brother. There's trouble there."
Sophia was only permitted to leave the house every few days to visit the old widow's home on the other side of the valley. She carried a basket, or sometimes pulled a sled piled high with furs and food bound up in woolen blankets. Always she wore the horrible cloak, and as Koja watched her slogging along, he was reminded of a pilgrim going to do her penance. For the first mile, Sophia kept a steady pace and stayed to the path, but when she reached a small clearing, far from the outskirts of town and deep within the quiet of snow, she stopped. She slumped down on a fallen tree trunk, put her face in her hands, and wept. The fox felt suddenly ashamed to be watching her, but he also knew this was an opportunity. He hopped silently onto the other end of the tree trunk and said,
"Why do you cry, girl?"
Sophia gasped. Her eyes were red, her pale skin blotchy, but despite this and her gruesome wolfhood, she was still lovely. She looked around, her even teeth worrying the flesh of her lip.
"You should leave this place, fox," she said. "You are not safe here."
"I haven't been safe since I slipped yowling from my mother's body."
She shook her head.
"You don't understand. My brother.
What would he want with me? I'm too scrawny to eat and too ugly to wear."
Sophia smiled slightly.
"Your coat is a bit patchy, but you're not so bad as all that."
"No," said the fox. "Shall I travel to Osalta to have my portrait painted?"
"What does a fox know of the capital?"
"I visited once," said Koja,
for he sensed she might enjoy a story.
"I was the queen's personal guest. She tied a blue ribbon around my neck, and I slept upon a velvet cushion every night."
The girl laughed, her tears forgotten.
"Did you now?"
"I was quite the fashion. All the courtiers dyed their hair red and cut holes in their clothes, hoping to emulate my patchy coat."
"I see," said the girl. "So, why leave the comforts of the grand palace and come to these cold woods?"
"I made enemies."
"The queen's poodle grew jealous?"
"The king was offended by my overlarge ears."
"A dangerous thing," she said, "with such big ears. Who knows what gossip you might hear?"
This time Koja laughed, pleased that the girl showed some wit when she wasn't locked up with a brute. Sophia's smile faltered. She shot to her feet and picked up her basket, hurrying back down the path. But before she disappeared from view, she paused and said,
"Thank you for making me laugh, fox. I hope I will not find you here again."
Later that night, Lula fluffed her wings in frustration.
"You learned nothing. All you did was flirt."
"It was a beginning, little bird," said Koja. "Best to move slowly.
Then he lunged at her, jaws snapping. The nightingale shrieked and fluttered up into the high branches as Red Badger laughed.
"See," said the fox, "we must take care with shy creatures."
The next time Sophia ventured out to the widow's home, the fox followed her once more. Again she sat down in the clearing, and again she wept. Koja hopped up on the fallen tree.
"Tell me, Sophia, why do you cry?"
"You're still here, fox. Don't you know my brother is near? He will catch you eventually."
"What would your brother want with a yellow-eyed bag of bones and fleas?"
Sophia gave a small smile. "Yellow is an ugly color," she admitted. "With such big eyes, I think you see too much."
"Will you not tell me what troubles you?"
She didn't answer. Instead, she reached into her basket and took out a wedge of cheese. "Are you hungry?" The fox licked his chops. He'd waited all morning for the girl to leave her brother's house and had missed his breakfast. But he knew better than to take food from the hand of a human, even if the hand was soft-skinned and finely made. When he did not move, the girl shrugged and took a bite of it herself.
"What of the hungry widows?"
asked Koja.
"Let them starve,"
she said with some fire, and shoved another piece of cheese into her mouth.
"Why do you stay with him?"
asked Koja.
"You're pretty enough to catch a husband."
"Pretty enough," said the girl. "Would I be better served by yellow eyes and two large ears?"
"Then you would be plagued by suitors."
Koja hoped she might laugh again, but instead, Sophia sighed. A mournful sound that the wind picked up and lofted into the gray slate sky.
"We move from town to town,"
she said.
"In Balakirev, I almost had a sweetheart. My brother was not pleased. I keep hoping he will find a bride or allow me to marry, but I do not think he will."
Her eyes filled with tears once more.
"Come now," said the fox. "Let there be no more crying. I have spent my life finding my way out of traps. Surely I can help you escape your brother."
"Just because you escape one trap doesn't mean you will escape the next."
So Koja told her how he'd outsmarted his mother, the hounds, and even Ivan Gostov.
"You are a clever fox,"
she conceded when he was done.
"No," Koja said. "I am the cleverest. And that will make all the difference. Now, tell me of your brother."
Sophia glanced up at the sun. It was long past noon.
"Tomorrow," she said, "when I return."
She left the wedge of cheese on the fallen tree, and once she was gone, Koja sniffed it carefully. He looked right and left, then gobbled it down in one bite and did not spare a thought for the poor hungry widows. Koja knew he had to be especially cautious now if he hoped to loosen Sophia's tongue. He knew what it was to be caught in a trap. Sophia had lived that way a long time, and a lesser creature might choose to live in fear rather than grasp at freedom. So the next day he waited at the clearing for her to return from the widow's home, but kept out of sight. Finally she came trundling over the hill, dragging her sled behind her, the wool blankets bound with twine, the heavy runners sinking into the snow. When she reached the clearing, she hesitated.
"Fox?"
she said softly.
"Koja?"
Only then, when she had called for him, did he appear. Sophia gave a tremulous smile. She sank down on the fallen tree and told the fox of her brother. Jurek was a late riser, but regular in his prayers. He bathed in ice-cold water and ate 6 eggs for breakfast every morning. Some days he went to the tavern, others he cleaned hides, and sometimes he simply seemed to disappear.
"Think very carefully," said Koja. "Does your brother have any treasured objects? An icon he always carries? A charm? Even a piece of clothing he never travels without?"
Sophia considered this.
"He has a little pouch he wears on his watch fob. An old woman gave it to him years ago, after he saved her from drowning. We were just children.
But even then, Jurek was bigger than all the other boys. When she fell into the Sokol, he dove in after and dragged her back up its banks.
Is it dear to him?
He never removes it, and he sleeps with it cradled in his palm.
She must have been a witch, said Koja. That charm is what allows him to enter the forest so silently, to leave no tracks and make no sound. You will get it from him.
Sophia's face paled. No, she said. No, I cannot. For all his snoring, my brother sleeps lightly. And if he were to discover me in his chamber...
She shuddered. Meet me here again in 3 days' time, said Koja, and I will have an answer for you.
Sophia stood and dusted the snow from her horrible cloak. When she looked at the fox, her eyes were grave. Do not ask too much of me, she said softly.
Koja took a step closer to her. I will free you from this trap, he said. Without his charm, your brother will have to make his living like an ordinary man. He will have to stay in one place, and you will find yourself a sweetheart.
She wrapped the cables of her sled around her hand. Maybe, Sophia said. But first, I must find my courage. It took a day and a half for Koja to reach the marshes where a patch of dropwort grew. He was careful digging the little plants up. The roots were deadly. The leaves would be enough to manage Jurek. By the time he returned to his own woods, the animals were in an uproar. The boar, Tatya, had gone missing, along with her 3 piglets. The next afternoon, their bodies were spitted and cooking on a cheery bonfire in the town square. Red Badger and his family were packing up to leave, and they weren't the only ones.
He leaves no tracks, cried the badger. His rifle makes no sound. He is not natural, Fox, and your clever mind is no match for him. Stay, said Koja. He's a man, not a monster. And once I have robbed him of his magic, we will be able to see him coming. The wood will be safe once more.
Red Badger did not look happy. He promised to wait a little while longer, but he did not let his children stray from the burrow.
Boil them down,
Koja told Sophia when he met her in the clearing to give her the dropwort leaves.
Then add the water to his wine. And he'll sleep like the dead. You can take the charm from him unhindered. Just leave something useless in its place.
You're sure of this?
Do this small thing and you will be free.
But what will become of me?
I will bring you chickens from Tupolev's farm and kindling to keep you warm. We will burn the horrible cloak together.
It hardly seems possible. Koja darted forward and nudged her trembling hand once with his muzzle, then slipped back into the wood.
Freedom is a burden, but you will learn to bear it. Meet me tomorrow, and all will be well.
Despite his brave words, Koja spent the night pacing his den. Jurek was a big man. What if the dropwort was not enough? What if he woke when Sophia tried to take his precious charm? And what if they were successful? Once Jurek lost the witch's protection, the forest would be safe. And Sophia would be free. Would she leave then? Go back to her sweetheart in Balakirev? Or might he persuade his friend to stay? Koja got to the clearing early the next day. He padded over the cold ground. The wind had a blade's edge, and the branches were bare. If the hunter kept preying upon the animals, they would not survive the season. The woods of Polvost would be emptied. Then Sophia's shape appeared in the distance. He was tempted to run to meet her, but he made himself wait. When he saw her pink cheeks and that she was grinning beneath the hood of her horrible cloak, his heart leapt.
Well?
He asked, as she entered the clearing, quiet on her feet as always. With her hem brushing the path behind her, it was almost as if she left no tracks. Come, she said, eyes twinkling. Sit down beside me. She spread a woolen blanket on the fallen tree and opened her basket. She unpacked another wedge of the delicious cheese, a loaf of black bread, a jar of mushrooms, and a gooseberry tart glazed in honey. Then she held out her closed fist. Koja bumped it with his nose. She uncurled her fingers. In her palm lay a tiny cloth bundle, bound with blue twine and a piece of bone. It smelled of something rotten.
Koja released a breath.
"I feared he might wake," he said at last. She shook her head.
"He was still asleep when I left him this morning."
They opened the charm and looked through it. A small gold button, dried herbs, and ashes. Whatever magic might have worked inside it was invisible to their eyes.
"Fox, do you really believe this is what gave him his power?"
Koja batted the remains of the charm away.
"Well, it wasn't his wits."
Sophia smiled and pulled a jug of wine from the basket. She poured some for herself and then filled a little tin dish for Koja to lap up. They ate the cheese and the bread and all of the gooseberry tart.
"Snow is coming," Sophia said as she gazed into the gray sky.
"Will you return to Balakirev?"
"There is nothing for me there,"
Sophia said.
"Then you will stay? To see the snow?"
"Long enough for that."
Sophia poured more wine into the dish.
"Now, Fox, tell me again how you outsmarted the hounds."
So Koja told the tale of the foolish hounds and asked Sophia what wishes she might make, and at some point his eyes began to droop. The fox fell asleep with his head in the girl's lap, happy for the first time since he'd gazed upon the world with his two clever eyes. He woke to Sophia's knife at his belly, to the nudge of the blade as it began to wiggle beneath his skin. When he tried to scramble away, he found his paws were bound.
"Why?"
he gasped as Sophia worked the knife in deeper.
"Because I am a hunter," she said with a shrug.
Koja moaned.
"I wanted to help you."
"You always do,"
murmured Sophia.
"Few can resist the sight of a pretty girl crying."
A lesser creature might have begged for his life, given in to the relentless spill of his blood on the snow. But Koja struggled to think. It was hard. His clever mind was muddled with dropwort.
"Your brother..."
"My brother is a fool, who can barely stand to be in the same room with me, but his greed is greater than his fear.
So he stays, and drinks away his terror, and while you are all watching him and his gun, and talking of witches, I make my way through the woods." Could it be true? Had it been Jurek who kept his distance, who drowned his fear in bottles of wine, who stayed away from his sister as much as he could? Had it been Sophia who had brought the gray wolf home, and Jurek who had filled their house with people so he wouldn't have to be alone with her? Like Koja, the villagers had credited Jurek with the kill. They'd praised him, demanded stories that weren't rightfully his. Had he offered up the wolf's head as some kind of balm to his sister's pride? Sophia's silent knife sank deeper. She had no need for clumsy bows or noisy rifles. Koja whimpered his pain.
"You are clever,"
she said thoughtfully, as she started to peel the pelt from his back.
"Did you never notice the sled?"
Koja clawed at his thoughts, looking for sense. Sophia had sometimes trailed a sled behind her to carry food to the widow's home. He remembered now that it had also been heavy when she had returned. What horrors had she hidden beneath those woolen blankets? Koja tested his bonds. He tried to rattle his drugged mind from its stupor.
"It's always the same trap," she said gently. "You longed for conversation. The bear craved jokes. The gray wolf missed music. The boar just wanted someone to tell her troubles to. The trap is loneliness, and none of us escapes it. Not even me."
"I am a magic fox,"
he rasped.
"Your coat is sad and patchy. I will use it for a lining. I will keep it close to my heart."
Koja reached for the words that had always served him, the wit that had been his tether and his guide. His clever tongue would not oblige. He moaned as his life bled into the snowbank to water the fallen tree. Then, hopeless and dying, Koja did what he had never done before. He cried out. And high in the branches of her birch tree, the nightingale heard. Lula came flying, and when she saw what Sophia had done, she set upon her, pecking at her eyes. Sophia screamed and slashed at the little bird with her knife, but Lula's beak was sharp. She did not relent. In the wood, even songbirds must be survivors. It took 2 days for Sophia to stumble from the woods, blind and near starving. In time, her brother found a more modest house and set himself up as a woodcutter, work to which he was well suited. His new bride was troubled by his sister's mad ramblings of foxes and wolves. With little regret, Lev Jurek sent Sophia to live at the widow's home. They took her in, mindful of the charity she'd once shown them, but though she'd brought them food, she'd never offered warm words or company. She'd never bothered to make them her friends. And soon, their gratitude exhausted, the old women grumbled over the care Sophia required, and left her to huddle by the fire in her horrible cloak. As for Koja, his fur never sat quite right again. He took more care in his dealings with humans, even the foolish farmer Tupolev. The other animals took greater care with Koja, too. They teased him less. And when they visited the fox and Lula, they never said an unkind word about the way his coat bunched at his neck. The fox and the nightingale made a quiet life together. A lesser creature might have held Koja's mistakes against him, might have mocked him for his pride. But Lula was not only clever, she was wise.
The Witch of Duva. There was a time when the woods near Duva ate girls. It had been many years since any child was taken, but still, on nights like these, when the wind comes cold from Tzibea, mothers hold their daughters tight and warn them not to stray too far from home. "Be back before dark," they whisper. "The trees are hungry tonight." In those black days, on the edge of these very woods, there lived a girl named Nadia, and her brother, Havel, the children of Maxim Grushov, a carpenter and woodcutter. Maxim was a good man, well-liked in the village. He made roofs that did not leak or bend, sturdy chairs, toys when they were called for, and his clever hands could fashion edges so smooth and fasten joints so neatly you might never find the seam. He traveled all over the countryside seeking work, to towns as far as Rivost. He went by foot and by hay cart when the weather was kind, and in the winter he hitched his 2 black horses to a sledge, kissed his children, and set out in the snow. Always he returned home to them, carrying bags of grain or a new bolt of wool, his pockets stuffed with candy for Nadia and her brother. But when the famine came, people had no coin, and nothing to trade for a prettily carved table or a wooden duck. They used their furniture for kindling, and prayed they would make it through to spring. Maxim was forced to sell his horses, and then the sledge they'd once pulled over the snow-blanketed roads. As Maxim's luck faded, so did his wife. Soon she was more ghost than woman, drifting silently from room to room. Nadia tried to get her mother to eat what little food they had, giving up portions of turnip and potato, bundling her mother's frail body in shawls, and seating her on the porch in the hope that the fresh air might return some appetite to her. The only thing she seemed to crave were little cakes made by the widow, Karina Stoyanova, scented with orange blossom and thick with icing. Where Karina got the sugar, no one knew, though the old women had their theories, most of which involved a rich and lonely tradesman from the river cities. The thaw came, then the summer, another failed harvest. Eventually, even Karina's supplies dwindled, and when the little cakes were gone, Nadia's mother would touch neither food nor drink, not even the smallest sip of tea.
Nadia's mother died on the first real day of winter, when the last bit of autumn fled from the air, and any hope of a mild year went with it. But the poor woman's death passed largely unremarked upon, because 2 days before she finally breathed her last ghostly sigh, another girl went missing. Her name was Lara Denikin, a shy girl with a nervous laugh, the type to stand at the edges of village dances watching the fun. All they found of her was a single leather shoe, its heel thick with crusted blood. She was the second girl lost in as many months after Shura Yashevsky went out to hang the wash on the line and never came back in, leaving nothing but a pile of clothespins and sodden sheets lying in the mud. Real fear came upon the town. In the past, girls had vanished every few years. True, there were rumors of girls being taken from other villages from time to time, but those children hardly seemed real. Now, as the famine deepened and the people of Duva went without, it was as if whatever waited in the woods had grown greedier and more desperate, too. Lara, Shura, all those who had gone before, Betya, Ludmila, Reza, Nikolena, other names now forgotten. In those days they were whispered like an incantation. Parents sent up prayers to their saints. Girls walked in pairs. People watched their neighbors with wary eyes. On the edge of the woods, the townspeople built crooked altars, careful stacks of painted icons, burnt-down prayer candles, little piles of flowers and beads. Men grumbled about bears and wolves. They organized hunting parties, talked about burning sections of the forest. Poor, bumbling Yuri Pankin was nearly stoned to death when he was found in possession of one of the missing girl's dolls, and only his mother's weeping and her insistence that she had found the sorry thing on the Vestopol Road saved him. Some wondered if the girls might have just walked into the wood, lured by their hunger. There were smells that wafted off the trees when the wind blew a certain way. Impossible scents of lamb dumplings or sour cherry babka. Nadia had almost given in to them herself, sitting on the porch beside her mother, trying to get her to take another spoonful of broth. She would smell roasting pumpkin, walnuts, brown sugar, and find her feet carrying her down the stairs toward the waiting shadows where the trees shuffled and sighed, as if ready to part for her. Stupid Nadia, you think. Stupid girls, I would never be so foolish. But you've never known real hunger. The crops have been good these last years, and people forget what the lean times are like. They forget the way mothers smothered infants in their cribs to stop their hungry howls, or how the trapper, Leonid Jemka, was found gnawing on the muscle of his slain brother's calf when their hut was iced in for 2 long months. Sitting on the porch of Baba Olya's house, the old women peered into the forest and muttered, "Kitka." The word raised the hairs on Nadia's arms. But she was no longer a child, so she laughed with her brother at such silly talk. The Kitki were spiteful forest spirits, bloodthirsty and vengeful. But in stories they were known to hunger after newborns, not full-grown girls near old enough to marry.
"Who can say what shapes an appetite?" Baba Olya said with a dismissive wave of her gnarled hand. "Maybe this one is jealous or angry. Maybe it just likes the taste of our girls," said Anton Kozar, limping by on his one good leg and waggling his tongue obscenely. The old women squawked like geese, and Baba Olya hurled a rock at him. War veteran or no, the man was disgusting. When Nadia's father heard the old women muttering that Duva was cursed and demanding that the priest say blessings in the town square, he simply shook his head.
"It's just an animal," he insisted. "A wolf, mad with hunger."
Maxim knew every path and corner of the forest. So he and his friends took up their rifles and headed back into the woods, full of grim determination. But again they found nothing. And the old women grumbled louder. What animal left no tracks? No trail, no trace of a body.
Suspicion crept through the town. That lecherous Anton Kozar had returned from the northern front much changed.